Hi, everyone, and welcome to another episode of All Crime, No Cattle. I'm Erin.
And I am Shay.
And thank you all for tuning in to episode 52. We have, from what I understand, another very tragic case that made big news across the nation.
Yep, that's right. We're doing another tragic one. We're going to be plucking on your heartstrings. It's a worthwhile tale and definitely worth telling. Well, I don't believe we have anything else, so let's just go ahead and get started with this week's episode. On September 15th, 1999, almost 200 young teens and a handful of adults gathered at Wedgwood Baptist Church in South Fort Worth. The afternoon and evening was supposed to be filled with prayers, sermons, Christian rock music, and meaningful skits. The congregation was in high spirits and had no idea that something horrible was approaching. Their service that day was dedicated to the love and remembrance in the honor of victims of another mass shooting. But everything was about to change. Bullets, bombs, and blood were coming for them too, in the form of a man dressed in black. This is episode 52, The Wedgwood Shooter.
This girl got shot and someone held her up and going, "Oh my God, oh my God," after my youth minister said they heard a muffle. Like, I don't know what that means. And then everyone started running to that little girl. That's when I got up and started running off because I was, like, scared.
He was just shooting repeatedly, and I saw him let the bullets out the thing. He re-lettered his gun, like, twice, and then he was just shooting everybody, and this one girl got shot in those in front of me, and everybody was just scared. We just all thought it was part of the skit we were supposed to have, but then we realized it wasn't. Everybody, all the kids just evacuated from the building, and we all ran out to the side and realized a lot of girls and boys had got shot.
I was sitting there praying because you never think something like this would happen. I was just scared, and I just couldn't wait to get out of there. And it's just, like, real scary because I heard, like, this shot go over my head, and it was, like, real warm. I'm, like, real scared that something's, like, fixing to happen to me right there, and everything was just going to end right there.
So let's get into some sources for today. The audio clips that you just heard are from Dateline and WFAA Channel 8 News, as well as CNN. I used a Houston Press article by Carlton Stowers that was also published in the Dallas Morning News and the Dallas Observer. I used a World Magazine segment by Lynn Vincent, a Time Magazine article from David Biema, a Fort Worth Star-Telegram article by Domingo Ramirez Jr., and this is the only one that I used that is not from 1999. It is a current article in kind of the anniversary style fashion. I also used the WedgwoodBaptistChurch.org website, and they had some really good information on this case. And lastly, I used the New York Times. They did about 6 different articles on this case over the course of a couple of months in 1999 when this all went down. And the authors of those articles are Adam Clymer, Gustav Nyberg, Jim Yardley, Dirk Johnson, and Lori Goodstein. So as I mentioned before, we're back in our neck of the woods this week, meaning Fort Worth, Texas. And just like the broomstick killer, this case hits really close to home for me. I've mentioned before that I grew up during the 80s and 90s on the south side of Fort Worth, in a small suburb of Everman. But I was also very familiar with the surrounding neighborhoods on the south side, especially the ones just over the highway like Wedgwood. I actually used to go to church with my grandparents at St. Bartholomew's in Wedgwood. I even went on one of my first dates at the nearby West Creek Bowling Alley. Back then, Wedgwood to me seemed like a nice neighborhood with lots of larger ranch-style brick houses, which were home to a middle to upper middle class community. It seemed quiet and relaxed with a good mix of working professionals as well as retirees. If you have heard of Wedgwood, chances are you probably know it for being the neighborhood nearest to the Hewlett Mall, just to its south and southeast. This case also really sticks out to me because it made national news when I was in high school. It put South Fort Worth under the media microscope, and it would even become the center of a hot debate topic during the 2000 presidential elections. Not only was this case covered by some of the largest news outlets in the country, but it also had a big effect on state and local politics for reasons that we'll get into at the end of this episode. Our story starts today with what are known as See You at the Poll rallies. These are student-led religious rallies, typically Christian in nature, that are said to provide students with a constitutional way of praying at school and celebrating their religious identity. How it works is schools cannot sponsor or participate in these activities. They must happen outside of school hours and be student-led activities. As the name suggests, these rallies were typically centered around the flagpole at school campuses. Well, the reason I bring this all up is not to get into religion, politics, or the separation of church and state here in America, but rather to point out that today's story starts with a See You at the Poll rally that was occurring simultaneously across the country at thousands of schools on September 15, 1999. In fact, many of the young congregation of Wedgewood Baptist Church were in attendance at See You at the Poll rallies that were occurring at four different high schools in the surrounding area. It was reported the theme of the prayer rally was a moment of silent prayer for those affected by the Columbine shooting spree just a few months earlier on April 20th. The students reportedly prayed for the 13 fallen students and teachers, the 20-plus injured survivors, and their affected families. Students in attendance said it was a somber rally, but one of hope, love, and remembrance. After the See You at the Poll rally concluded, students began arriving at Wedgewood Baptist Church.
Okay, so the events that we're talking about today didn't actually happen at a See You at the Poll rally that was being held at a school. This is afterwards when people are now congregating back up at these churches to continue the sort of the day of remembrance.
Yes, that's correct. And, you know, in this case, that often gets confused and misreported. And a lot of people come out believing that this case occurred at a See You at the Poll rally, which is just not true.
Yeah, okay. Well, that's good to know because that's what I thought.
And a lot of people think the same thing. So the reason why these students were coming back to Wedgewood Baptist Church was, you see, Wednesday evenings at the church were known as youth nights. This large red brick church was, and still is, a pillar of the South Fort Worth community. And it's always been focused on a strong youth movement and youth congregation since its inception. So back in 1956, a young seminary student named Harry Harris began to see the need for a Baptist church in the newly expanding suburb of Wedgewood. By 1960, Harris's vision had become a reality. The Wedgewood Church was officially established with an initial membership of 220 members and a large Sunday school youth program with over 330 children enrolled. And like I said, the congregation had a focus on youth programs and alternative worship services since the beginning. They had activities and wanted to really make a safe place for children and teens to go after school was over. And this is also in an area where there's a lot of dangerous after-school activities that students can be getting into. So this is a way of keeping kids off the street. By the mid-90s, this church had grown to over 1,200 members, and they actually built a new, larger community life center to hold all their members in their large youth program. Groundbreaking for this structure happened on September of 1998, about a year before our events. Some of the structure was still in construction phases that evening on September 1999, but the shining jewel, the large worship hall, was fully constructed and functional. The large interior could hold over 1,000 members of the congregation comfortably, with its expanded large balcony section and spacious interior. That night, almost 200 members of the youth program were inside the main worship hall, and they were listening to Christian rock music from a band named 40 Days that was performing on stage. The New York Times later talked with several of the teens regarding their church, the youth program, and what a place like this meant for suburban teenagers. One of the members, Adrian Moore, a 20-year-old who worked in the church's bookstore, said, quote, "Wednesday nights are special to a lot of kids here. A lot of teenagers don't even belong to a church because their parents just don't go. So the Wednesday night services are all they got," end quote. These services were also different from the more proper and traditional services of Sundays. They were open to non-members and teens could bring their friends, and it seemed like they just really enjoyed the music and the loose atmosphere. It was also kind of a chance to be loud, come together, and let out some stress. Young students and alumni from Southwestern Baptist Theological Seminary, which is also nearby us in South Fort Worth, spent a lot of their spare time assisting with the youth program and mentoring services at Wedgwood Baptist. Susan Jones and Sean Brown, both 23, were two of the students that were there in attendance that night. One of the seminary alumni and the church's leaders was also there that night, and that was 36-year-old Sydney Browning. She graduated from Southwestern Baptist Theological Seminary with a religious education master's degree in 1991. After she started working as a teacher at Success High School in Fort Worth's inner city, she also came to Wedgwood Baptist and helped out with the mentoring and their youth program. As a teacher, Sydney excelled at working with troubled teens, some of whom were drug users, convicted juveniles, homeless, or even gang members. She was passionate about her work, so much that on Wednesday nights, after she finished teaching at Success High School, she would drive down to Wedgwood Baptist and help out where she could. By 6:55 p.m., everything had gone off without a hitch. The youth program was in full swing, and inside the main sanctuary, a large crowd of teenagers swayed and sang to the music. Sydney Browning, Sean Brown, and a 36-year-old church custodian named Jeff Laster were all out in the main hallway of Wedgwood Baptist Church. Inside the sanctuary hall, 40 Days just started playing one of their songs called Ale Alleluia. That's when a stranger appeared. He was tall, slim, and an older-looking man. He stood motionless at the large glass front doors of the church. From outside, he slammed his fist against the doors, drawing Sydney, Sean, and Jeff's attention. The man wore a black baseball cap pulled down low, a black leather jacket, and blue jeans. In his mouth was a lit cigarette. Hidden in his jacket pockets were two loaded semi-automatic pistols, 10 full magazines, and a homemade pipe bomb. The strange man opened the door and began walking down the hallway with purpose, smoke billowing out from underneath his black baseball cap. Custodian Jeff Laster walked towards the strange man. As he did, he passed Sydney Browning, who was seated on a couch nearby, just a short distance down the main hallway. Laster got within arm's length of the man in black and told him he needed to extinguish his cigarette outside before coming in. The man lifted his head, looked at Laster for a moment, and then without speaking pulled a Ruger 9mm from his jacket and shot Laster in the stomach. Laster grabbed at his wound as he fell to the floor. As the shot rang out, Sydney Brown looked up, just in time to see the man pointing a gun at her. He pulled the trigger methodically, shooting her in the head with a single shot. Sydney died instantly. The man calmly stepped over Laster's body as he lay on the ground bleeding and critically injured. The attacker moved down the hallway to the area where Sean Brown, the 23-year-old seminary student, sat manning the 40 Days merch table. Sean got up from the table, and instead of fleeing to a nearby exit door, he headed down the hall, towards the shooter. The strange man lifted his gun yet again and fired, killing Sean.
Wow, do we know why he chose to do that?
You know, nobody really knows. His wife said that, you know, he liked to think of himself as a brave person, and he always tried to help people. She thinks that he was very worried about the teenagers and youth congregation that were inside and probably trying to help.
So maybe actually trying to go talk to the shooter, like talk him down, maybe something
perhaps
like that.
But I mean, he was unarmed. He had nothing.
Yeah.
Know? It was actually at this moment that Glenn Busey Jr., a 17-year-old who was sitting in one of the rear pews of the main sanctuary hall, thought that he heard some gunfire. He turned around just in time to see a man he didn't recognize staring through one of the glass doors and looking into the main sanctuary. He later told Dateline in an interview that from the back pew where he was sitting, he locked eyes with the man, quote, just for a second. He looked really angry. And then he raised his gun and started shooting straight through the glass door into the sanctuary at us, end quote. Glenn also explained how once the shooting started, he grabbed his younger brother Benji and best friend Alex, who were sitting on either side of him, and dove to the floor. Glass rained down on top of them as the glass doors shattered from repeated gunfire. The three boys crawled underneath the pew for safety. Quote, I pushed them under there and I told them don't move, don't make any noises, don't do anything to get his attention, end quote. As they laid there, more shots rang out over and over. Strangely enough, Glenn recalled people clapping and cheering at the shooter. The reason why? Apparently there was a skit planned for that evening that was supposed to include something about the fragile nature of human life and its importance.
Oh, God. So people thought that this was a skit. They thought it was fake.
Yes. So a lot of the youth congregation said that they thought it was some sort of elaborate skit where this had all been planned out. And, you know, there are students and teenagers there who were visiting from other churches who are just there to see 40 days. And they're not familiar with this church. So they're thinking, well, maybe this is something that they do. You know, maybe they just get really into it. They have this really great band playing. You know, this is crazy.
Wow, that is terrifying.
Yeah, so a lot of the congregation, according to multiple witnesses, said that kids and even some adults were laughing at the shooter initially and then even shouting for him to shoot at them. Like, shoot me, shoot me.
But I mean, this is after he has presumably shot through those glass windows and broken all those windows. And people still thought that
they thought
that was
it,
a
it
part
was,
of it?
Yeah, they thought that it was arranged or part of it somehow.
Wow.
From Glenn's spot underneath the pew, he could hear the shooter cussing at the children in anger as he shot towards them and yelled things like, quote, "This is real. This is fucking real." Glenn quickly realized this was not a skit, and he kept his brother and his friend quiet and as still as he could. As they laid and watched, the man in the leather jacket paced back and forth just feet from them at the rear of the sanctuary. He kept firing down into the crowd of teenagers, into the pews, and even up at the band on stage. At some point, the shooter pulled out a second pistol, a .38 AMT backup, and began firing with both guns. Witnesses who were there that night said the shooter was clearly angry and full of rage as he shot. He cursed obscenities at the children and blasphemed their religion. As for the shooting itself, he went about it slowly, methodically, and with purpose. He reloaded the two pistols multiple times and kept firing down at them, lit cigarettes still dangling from his lips. At one point in the attack, there was a lull in the fire. After a few seconds, a pipe bomb with a lit fuse came flying towards the stage. Before it could hit the ground, though, it ripped open in a loud blast. According to the Houston Press and the Fort Worth Star-Telegram, the fuse was most likely too short as the homemade explosive did not land and explode horizontally, but rather exploded in the air vertically, luckily limiting its damage potential.
Wow, so this guy brought extra ammunition, two guns, and pipe bombs.
That's right. Yeah, and I can only imagine, I hate to imagine, if he had thrown that pipe bomb like down into one of the crowded pews or up onto the stage, it could have hurt so many more people.
Yeah.
Even though the pipe bomb didn't prove deadly, it still sent shrapnel into the crowd and the surrounding structures. The resulting damage caused several large light fixtures to come crashing down from the high ceilings, and a few actually landed on teenagers and adults. In all the destruction and devastation, it's said that one young man sat alone in a pew. He wasn't moving much, screaming, or hiding from the shooter. He was simply praying. His name was Jeremiah Nitz. According to the Houston Press and the Dallas Observer, this 19-year-old former lineman was visiting from some other congregation called South Wayside Baptist Church. Their youth pastor, Adam Hammond, had recommended this event after seeing one of the flyers that was going around the Baptist community. Hammond lay on the ground underneath the pew near Jeremiah. As bullets flew by, he begged Jeremiah to take cover, even going so far as pulling on his leg. According to multiple witnesses, the boy didn't move and kept up his prayers in full view of the shooter. Jeremiah was also seated near the rear of the sanctuary, close to the glass door where the shooter had entered. Quote, "I was sitting there just praying it would end. And then he approached me. I turned and looked at him. I really couldn't see his face that well because of the dim light and the way he had his cap pulled down on his forehead. But he seemed very calm. I don't know why, but I just sat there, looking at him as he came towards me. When he got within about 5 feet, he pointed one of his guns at me and just glared. I told him, 'Sir, you don't have to be doing this.' He told me to shut the hell up. Then he asked me what my religion was, and I told him I was a Christian, a Baptist. He said, 'That sucks,' and that it was a stupid religion. 'No, sir,' I said, 'it doesn't suck. It's a wonderful thing. God put me on this earth for a reason, and I'm certain of that.'" End quote. The shooter looked away for a moment and fired off a series of shots across the sanctuary. "This religion is bullshit," the shooter yelled before returning to stare at Jeremiah and pointing the gun at his face. "That's the only time I really noticed his face," Jeremiah remembered. "What I saw was pure rage." Earlier, 17-year-old Mary Beth Talley was handing out programs to latecomers when the shooting began. At that moment, she raced towards where her longtime friend was sitting, Heather McDonald. Heather has Down syndrome, and she was confused among the chaos. Heather's mother was having difficulty getting her daughter onto the floor and out of the line of fire. When Mary arrived, she threw her body over her friend as she heard Jeremiah confronting the shooter. She told Dateline, quote, "I heard him telling the man that he needed Jesus Christ, and I started praying to God he would protect him. Seconds later, a bullet hit Mary in the right shoulder. Mary and Heather tumbled to the floor together. Mary literally took a bullet for her friend."
Oh, wow.
Jeremiah explained what happened next to Carlton Stowers of the Houston Press. Quote, "That's when I stood up, and I looked at him and I told him, 'Sir, what you need is Jesus Christ in your life.' I told him that I knew where I was going when I died, and I asked, 'What about you?' He just looked at me for a second or two, and then said, 'Fuck off.'" End quote.
So he keeps engaging with this Jeremiah while he is simultaneously shooting all around the room?
Yeah, and a couple of times, like, he approaches Jeremiah, and people get terrified because they think that he's about to shoot him. But he's starting this dialogue with Jeremiah in the middle of this mass shooting.
That's so bizarre.
Yeah, it is really weird. Several of the witnesses confirmed that after Jeremiah and the shooter exchanged words, that he shot off that series of bullets that eventually hit Mary, who was protecting Heather. You know, this all lines up. It's not like in other situations where we've heard things like this in mass shootings, but this appears to have actually happened. Several witnesses also confirmed that right after this last exchange between Jeremiah and the shooter, that the strange man in black walked a few feet away, sat down in one of the rear pews, and put the gun to his head and casually pulled the trigger.
Oh my God. Wow, I didn't expect that.
Yeah. It's a weird case. It's very abrupt. A lot of things just happen out of nowhere. It's really, there's not a whole lot of rhyme or reason to it. And we're going to get into what we think could have caused this to happen later.
From start to finish, how long did this take?
It just a few minutes. It didn't take that long. It wasn't a long standoff or, you know, a prolonged mass shooting, like in some cases going room to room throughout an entire building. I mean, he pretty much just came down the hallway, shot three people, moved into the sanctuary, and started firing.
And then sat down and killed himself.
Exactly.
Wow.
So S.M. Gillette was a church member who actually lived across the street. He was watching television that evening when he noticed his dog, Jake, who was barking nonstop out the window. Gillette, an off-duty Fort Worth police officer, saw people fleeing out of the church and screaming, and he started to get concerned. So he grabbed his radio, and he radioed for police help, and then he grabbed his service revolver and rushed out towards the church. Once he made it to the church, he was joined by an ununiformed officer who had just arrived. These two men ran down the hallway and burst into the main sanctuary chamber just as the shooter turned the gun on himself and pulled the trigger. They were too late. It was all already over.
Yeah, I mean, that's really, I'm sure, unexpected. They were rushing in to try to help, and by the time they get there, it's all over. But at least they're immediately on the scene to hopefully start assisting with, I'm imagining, all of the people who are hurt.
Yeah, that's exactly what happened. Right after the two officers arrived, Jeremiah and others, along with these two officers, started helping people get out of the sanctuary, pulling some of the light fixtures off of them, turning over some of the pews that had been pushed over in the chaos, and trying to get as many of these people outside as possible. Jeremiah and Glenn actually helped out a lot at this point. They helped people get out of the sanctuary. They both spent about 2 hours carrying the wounded and the helpless to the front of the church's lawn. Both of these two young men witnessed several people die before they got medical attention. Jeremiah told the Houston Press, quote, "There was this one kid, I don't know his name. I helped him out of the church and onto the lawn out front. He had been shot in the back, but all I could remember was that he was a short kid and he was wearing a black t-shirt. After that happened, I went back into the church to help more people. In total, 7 people lay dead in the Wedgwood Baptist Church. 2 in the hallway and 5 in the main sanctuary, not including the shooter. another 7 lay out on the front lawn requiring serious medical attention. 4 of those 7 were critically wounded. 1 would later be paralyzed from the waist down. Mary Beth Talley was waiting on an ambulance with her friends. She had that bullet lodged in her shoulder, but she would survive. Several people helped to drag the custodian, Jeff Laster, from the hallway out onto the front lawn. He was unconscious, but he was alive. He too would survive, even though he was shot in the stomach. Much of the attack was captured on videotape, which was later turned over to the police. To my knowledge, it has never been made available to the public. The video itself was recorded by Justin Ray, who was 17 at the time. He had arrived earlier in the day to set up recording equipment to film 40 Day's performance. His body was later discovered among the dead in the sanctuary. Justin fell just a few feet away from his camera, which was still recording.
Oh my God.
Also among the dead in the main sanctuary were 3 other victims. Susan Kimberly Jones, that 23-year-old seminary student that we mentioned earlier in the episode, was one of the unfortunate victims. Today, she is still remembered by friends and family as a world traveler, a mentor to youth students that she worked with, and a beacon of positivity. If you want to learn more about Susan Kimberly Jones, her work as a youth counselor and a teacher has actually been immortalized by her family into a DVD called Going Home, The Journey of Kim Jones. It's available online, and their hope is that this memorial piece will be a lasting testament to the person that she was in life, and they also hope that it will touch others in need and help them learn one of Kim's favorite lessons that, quote, "We're basically a bunch of backpackers. We are all just travelers in life, on a journey of choices, and we're all heading for our home," end quote. You can find more about Kim Jones and her DVD at thelightstillshines.org. Christy Beckel, Cassandra Griffin, and Joseph D. Innes, all 3 were just 14 years old, and they did not survive the shooting either. Their bodies were also found in the main sanctuary. Many worried that the shooter still had explosives rigged to detonate after he killed himself. The Fort Worth bomb squad arrived and used a robot to check the shooter's body and the interior of the building for more explosives. It took 5 more hours to clear the building. Late that night, the bodies of the deceased were finally brought out of the church. Today, a large stone memorial stands at Wedgewood Baptist Church in all of their memories. It reads, "The Wedgewood Church Shooting, September 15, 1999. A disturbed gunman disrupted a youth prayer rally shouting obscenities, fired a handgun repeatedly, and exploded a pipe bomb. 14 persons were shot. 7 died. This is a memorial to their homecoming. The monument is 8-sided, and the other 7 sides have beautiful engravings of each of the victims and a short message about who they were in life. It's surrounded by 7 black stone benches representing the 7 surviving families, also providing them a place to mourn if they ever want to come to the memorial."
Oh, wow. That sounds like a very beautiful way to remember everyone and to memorialize it in a positive way.
Yeah.
Really remembering the victims.
Yeah, it is great. And there are pictures of this online, and we're going to provide pictures of it as well. But yeah, you know, I've never been to it. And we live so close on the south side of Fort Worth to where this happened. And I really want to go see it.
Yeah. Yeah, we should. Well, it's interesting because it sounds like a lot of the people, a lot of the victims and survivors were so heroic in their actions. A lot of them seem to have saved so many other people's lives, and especially Jeremiah. I mean, that's incredible that he had the wherewithal to actually try to talk to this person, try to engage with this person, maybe bring him down, and maybe that was a part of it.
Yeah, you know, he talks about that in a lot of his interviews with the Houston Press, and I recommend you go and read that great article by Carlton Stowers. It's really well written, and he spent a really long time with Jeremiah talking about how much he's thought about his role in this case. And Jeremiah was the one to point out in that interview that if the shooter had not killed himself at the end, he could have kept going on with the killing spree. They actually found 6 more magazines in the shooter's pockets that were unspent.
Oh, wow. So he had intentions of just killing everybody in that place.
As many as he possibly could, probably.
But just in the middle of it, he just sat down and killed himself.
Yeah, that's right. The acts of Glenn and Mary to help save as many people as possible are some of the stories of real heroes involved in this case. I also want to make clear that I've used some of these stories because these are some of the teenagers and the victims that have been very outspoken in this case and have been willing to talk to the media numerous times. There are a lot of other people who did heroic things who have kind of tried to stay out of the media, and I don't want to involve their names in this story for reasons of their privacy.
Yeah, absolutely.
Hey guys, I know some of you out there who listen to the show, you probably travel, right? Well, Aaron and I do too, and what does everybody need when they're traveling? Luggage. Well, I have something for you today, and it's called Away. Away Luggage uses high-quality materials while offering a much lower price compared to other brands by cutting out the middleman and selling directly to you. Choose from 9 colors and 4 sizes. All the suitcases are made with premium German polycarbonate, which is super tough. The interior features a patent-pending compression system, helpful for people like me and Aaron who are overpackers and put way too much in the suitcase. These bags are TSA approved with their combination locks that are specially built into the top of the bag to prevent theft. Both sizes of the carry-on are able to charge all cell phones, tablets, e-readers, and anything else that's powered by a USB cord. These pieces of luggage also have a lifetime warranty. If anything breaks, they will fix it and replace it for you for life. And if at any point you decide it's not for you, return it for a full refund, no questions asked. There is free shipping on any Away order within the lower 48 states. The carry-on sizes are compliant with all major U.S. airlines. These bags are great for us because there's so many times where we want to charge our phones or use an electrical device and not worry about them going dead while we're traveling. We got the black, and it's super sleek. It looks very durable. So for a special offer, make sure you head over to awaytravel.com/cattle and use promo code CATTLE during your checkout for $20 off of your suitcase. All right, now back to the show. So the 8th body, which we haven't discussed yet, belonged to the shooter. The angry man behind the carnage was 47-year-old Larry Jean Ashbrook. Immediately, not much was known about Ashbrook. He served 2 stints in the military, but was dishonorably discharged after he was court-martialed for possession of marijuana. The records also detailed 4 awards and decorations he earned in his 7 years of service. Authorities quickly discovered Ashbrook had been living alone in his recently deceased father's home in Forest Hill, Texas, for about the past 4 months. Forest Hill is another Fort Worth suburb about 9 miles east of Wedgewood. This is the neighborhood just north of my hometown, Everman. What was known about him was that Ashbrook was jobless, a loner, and no one at Wedgewood Baptist Church was familiar with Ashbrook or his family. There was no clear sign as to why Ashbrook had chosen this particular church or this day as his target. At a press conference after the shooting, acting Fort Worth Police Chief Ralph Mendoza said that they were not certain of Mr. Ashbrook's motives and were still investigating. So part of the problem was that Ashbrook left no suicide note or manifesto behind in his horrible wake. He did, however, leave behind a checkered past of strange behaviors and strong evidence of mental illness, which we're about to get into. In the months leading up to the shooting, Ashbrook actually called and wrote both the Fort Worth Star-Telegram and Fort Worth Weekly. Ashbrook's phone calls seemed like incoherent ramblings of a troubled man. In one of the phone calls to a Fort Worth Weekly reporter, he said he fantasized about serial killers, particularly Ricky Lee Green, a serial killer from Boyd, Texas, that was executed in 1997 for 4 killings. This is a really fascinating detail in the case to me because, as you know, Aaron, we have been working on a multi-parter for Ricky Lee Green for some time now, going back to last year.
Yeah, absolutely.
Regarding the letters Ashbrook wrote to the 2 papers, Bob Ray Sanders, the vice president and associate editor of the Star-Telegram, said, quote, "We get letters all the time, phone calls and whatnot. They don't make any sense. You think they're a little off, but then what do you do?" End quote. And I think that's a good point. We don't work at a newspaper, and a lot of people say, well, why didn't you do anything? Why didn't you alert someone to these weird phone calls and letters? But, you know, you've seen the news. People write in and call in and say really, really weird stuff.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's no way that they could follow up with every bizarre an angry rant that they get in voicemail or email or, you know, whatever. I mean, there's absolutely no way that they can do that. So,
yeah. Well, the following day after the shooting, Fort Worth police and agents of the FBI and the Federal Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms actually searched Ashbrook's Forest Hill home. What they found was even more confusing. In Ashbrook's personal items, they found what Chief Mendoza referred to as ledgers or journals of life complaints. These entries were dated and went all the way back to the early 80s. In them, Ashbrook complained about everything from his job, bad traffic, people he suspected that were out to get him, the government, and religion. The condition of the home was disturbing as well. Someone, most likely Ashbrook, had taken a crowbar and a shovel to the walls, floor, and ceiling, tearing up boards and drywall as if they were searching for something. All the drains in the home had been filled with concrete, and all the toilets had been smashed to pieces. Also, it was determined that Ashbrook likely poisoned some of his fruit trees that were growing in his front yard.
Wow. You know, this all sounds like the brother from Better Call Saul.
Oh, yeah. What was his name? Charlie?
Chuck, yeah.
Chuck, yeah.
Just sort of his paranoia and the breakdown of his reality and everything, and him thinking that there's stuff in his walls and he's being recorded and all of that kind of stuff.
Oh, yeah. I do remember that in the show. It is very similar.
Yeah.
Well, investigators cited these as signs that Ashbrook was a man that needed help and wasn't mentally stable, which I think is close to the truth.
Mm-hmm.
Officially, there is no record that Ashbrook had ever been treated at a public mental health center. No medications were found in his home during the search either. Family members of Ashbrook told authorities he had become increasingly paranoid in recent months. He told them things like he thought someone was framing him for serial murder and other crimes that he did not commit. Ashbrook also told friends and family members about some of his major conspiracies and personal fears. The list is long, but here are some of the more interesting ones that stuck out to me as possibly delusional. 1. The CIA was targeting him, and he never really goes into a good explanation as to why or what the purpose was, but for some reason he thought the CIA was out there to get him. Also, that he was a victim of some sort of psychological warfare being carried out by the government. That his co-workers were assaulting him in secret and covering it up so he couldn't prove it to anyone. That the FBI refused to listen to him and kicked him out of their offices on 2 different occasions. And finally, that he was being drugged by the police. Side note, Marjorie Posh, a special agent for the FBI in Dallas, said that there is no record of Mr. Ashbrook ever contacting or being contacted by the FBI. So all of these, I mean, I think it's obvious, all of them sound like they're just delusions that are being built up in his head.
Yeah, absolutely.
One of his last communications with the Fort Worth Star-Telegram ended with, quote, "I want someone to tell my story. No one will listen to me. No one will believe me," end quote. To me, it sounds very likely that Ashbrook was delusional to the point where he was seeing and hearing things that weren't real while living alone, probably compounded these issues. Just like you were saying with Chuck from Better Call Saul.
Sure.
Well, several of Ashbrook's neighbors were also interviewed by the local and national news. All of them had something to say about Ashbrook, and none of it was particularly good. Most viewed him as a strange man who was solitary, and a lot of them just refused to get involved with him because he had a very hot temper, and a lot of them just referred to him as, quote, "Weird Larry." One neighbor said Ashbrook thought people were out to get him. They said, quote, "Me and another neighbor sat in my yard. Mr. Ashbrook pulled up and saw us laughing. I think he thought we were laughing at him. So he slammed his car door shut and unzipped his pants and exposed himself. I haven't spoken to him since," end quote.
Oh, well, don't blame me there.
Yeah. Several neighbors also reported Ashbrook would get very violent and physical with his elderly father, Jack, when he was still alive. Sometimes he could be heard yelling at his father from several houses over. A few times he beat his father up and threw him to the ground in the front yard for neighbors to see. And, you know, I say all of this because it's pretty apparent that there were clear signs that something was not right with Ashbrook, and people are witnessing these things, and either it was just ignored, or it was tolerated, or people just went into their house and shut the door and didn't want to be a part of it. There's not a lot of police records of police being called out to his house to deal with him and his father. So it seems like everybody was just putting up with Weird Larry.
Yeah, I mean, other than the exposing himself and the physical assault on his father, I mean, those are things that obviously you would think people would follow up on and maybe get somebody in there to check on what's going on in that house. But, you know, all the other stuff, it's just he's a really weird guy. And you typically what we do with really weird people, because we all know Weird Larry, right? We all know a person who is bizarre, makes you uncomfortable, and you want to stay away from, and that's what you do. You just stay away from them, and you don't want to get involved.
Exactly. I also want to mention that Larry was very, very close to his mother, who became immobile later in life, and she ended up passing away a couple of years earlier. And then his dad died just 6 months before, ultimately, the shooting. So we're seeing people in his life being stripped away from him, and his spiral down into paranoia and delusion becoming greater and greater.
Yeah.
Lastly, a Houston area investigative journalist, John Craig, dug into Ashbrook's private connections and contacts. Craig discovered that Ashbrook had strong ties to the Phineas priesthood and the Christian Identity. Have you ever heard of these two groups, Aaron?
No, I don't think so.
Well, both of these are religious racial extremist groups. The Phineas priesthood have no official organization or have no discernible leadership or institutional structure. Mainly, it's an ideological philosophy, and it's often used as a title. As far as the title of Phineas priests go, that's awarded to someone who commits a Phineas action, meaning they follow the example of Phineas, a Hebrew man, according to the Old Testament, who was rewarded by God for killing an interfaith couple. The term Phineas action is used by white supremacists more broadly today, not only for the murders of interracial couples, but also for attacks on Jewish people and other non-white ethnic groups, multiculturalists, and anyone they see as their enemies. And this includes mainstream Christianity and mainstream religious sects of Christianity.
So it's a religious group, but it's an extremist religious group that's so far out there that they hate Christians.
Yes.
I mean, just like your everyday Christian.
Right.
That's complete news to me. That's utterly bizarre and scary. Is this a group that has a lot of people who are members of it? I mean, how ubiquitous is this group?
These two groups, Phineas priests as an ideology, and here in just a second, we're going to talk about Christian Identity. Both of them are very popular in prison, Aryan Brotherhood members, white nationalist gangs, neo-Nazis, this kind of group.
So just all of the garbage of society.
Yes.
Cool.
Well, Christian Identity that I mentioned just a minute ago is similar, but it's a little different. They are a Christian extremist sect that is a racist, anti-Semitic, and white supremacist interpretation of Christianity. They believe that only Germanic, Anglo-Saxon, Celtic, Nordic, Aryan people, and those of kindred blood are the descendants of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. So therefore, they are the descendants of the ancient Israelites. Everyone else, specifically Jewish people, are descended from Cain and therefore inherently evil.
It's so ludicrous that there are people in this world who believe such utter nonsense.
Yeah.
And are willing to kill for it.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. Willing to die and kill people for it, you know, for the cause. And who will stand behind it as the absolute truth that the mainstream Christianity and the government and, you know, whoever doesn't want you to know. I hate it. Well, as you can imagine, this is a potential and potent dangerous combination of the Phineas priest philosophy mixed with a touch of racist anti-Semitic Christianity. That's a deadly cocktail. And it seems like Larry was into this stuff.
Yeah.
And I also definitely need to point out again that both of these groups view mainstream Christianity as one of their biggest enemies. So this might be a reason why he picked a Baptist church to attack.
Wow. I had no idea that there was a schism like that. I mean, I would have never thought these crazy white supremacist groups, who are oftentimes religious extremists as well, have such hatred towards mainstream Christianity. I didn't know that.
Yeah, in fact, you might know some of their names, actually, because here are some of the famous members of these two groups. Samuel Bowers, the first Grand Wizard of the White Knights of the Ku Klux Klan.
Grand Wizard and White Knights. So stupid. They're like living a Game of Thrones fantasy.
Well, you might also know Byron De La Beckwith, the assassin of the NAACP and civil rights movement leader Medgar Evers. Also, Eric Rudolph, the Olympic Park bomber. August Chris III, a former American neo-Nazi leader and convicted child molester. And good old Timothy McVeigh, the Oklahoma City bomber.
A group of spineless, disgusting cowards. Interesting how that works out.
In the end, this is what I believe. I believe that Larry Ashbrook had a combination of factors that played a role in why he eventually became a spree killer. His expulsion from the military, his dishonorable discharge, and, you know, a lot of people think that his conflicts that he served in, he might have suffered from PTSD. We don't really know since he never went and got therapy or medical attention, but those could be factors. He had a clear and violent nature. We know that we had symptoms of paranoid delusions and possibly even symptoms of schizophrenia. He had these racist, anti-Semitic Christian philosophy ties that believe in attacking mainstream Christianity. And, you know, Ashbrook was jobless. He had a low self-esteem. He was financially crippled. He was likely about to lose the only thing that he had, which was his father's home. He also had no future. He had no goals to speak of. His life was pretty much over, and he was absolutely alone.
Yep, and all of those are very dangerous combinations, like you were saying. You can probably say those things about almost all of those people that you just listed.
Yep.
It's people who are filled with rage because their life sucks, and they want to blame it on somebody else, and that somebody else is somebody who doesn't look like them. And that's all there is to it.
Or believe something that they're just vehemently against. Like these poor kids who are there praying for the victims of Columbine, not hurting anyone.
Do you think it has something to do with Columbine? I mean, did he know that that's what that day was about?
I think people have looked into that and really tried hard to figure that out. But I don't think they've ever come up with anything.
Yeah, like maybe, but also maybe he just knew that there was a big event going on and that's why he chose that
day. Maybe he just picked up one of these flyers that the other people that were there found.
Yeah.
And decided, you know what? That's it. That's where I'm going.
Yeah. I mean, sometimes you can't even look too hard into the rationale behind what these people do because sometimes there isn't much of one.
Yeah.
That's sometimes even scarier than them having some crazy explanation for their actions. It's just somebody who they don't even try to explain themselves. I mean, what are we supposed to get out of this story?
Yeah, and I think that's a theme that we have in a lot of spree killings, a lot of people who suffer from delusions and schizophrenia. There aren't a lot of answers at the end of those stories and cases as to why. It's just something in their head gets flipped, a switch gets pulled, and that's it. That's all they need. And then the destruction begins.
Yeah.
Well, we've talked a little bit about Larry, and to finish up, we need to talk about what happened after these events at Wedgwood. So the two guns that Larry Ashbrook used in the shooting were bought in February of 1992 from a licensed firearms dealer in a flea market in Grand Prairie, Texas, Aaron. We've been there. It's Trader's Village.
Yeah, in general, a pretty cool place.
Yeah, it's like any flea market, but this one's massive and expansive, and they actually did used to sell guns. As of today, and not long after the Wedgwood shooting, Trader's Village ended allowing firearm sales within their gates. But I've heard from a little bird who does go to Trader's Village quite often that it still happens in the parking lot under the table.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I believe that.
At the press conference after the shooting, Fort Worth Mayor Kenneth Barr said, quote, "Fort Worth isn't the first place to have this kind of tragedy. My great fear is it won't be the last." Then President Bill Clinton offered his condolences to the survivors of the families of Fort Worth, saying, quote, "Yet again, we have seen a sanctuary violated by gun violence, taking children brimming with faith and promise and hope before their time," end quote. Then Governor George W. Bush, the Republican presidential frontrunner for the upcoming 2000 election, canceled campaign appearances in Michigan and went to a hospital in Fort Worth where he comforted families of the victims. Later in the debates with Democratic candidate Al Gore, the Wedgwood shooting, along with others like Columbine, the Dangerfield church shooting, and others, all became major talking points for both Bush and Gore for their differing political platforms. George Bush would go on to push for the eventual expansion of concealed carry laws here in Texas before leaving as governor. Specifically, this changed concealed carry firearms in public places like churches and schools as a sort of active shooter deterrent. So after his legislation passed, you could carry a gun into a church or onto a school campus, and I believe that's still the case today. Another effect of the Wedgwood shooting was that "see you at the poll" rallies slowed down and occurred less often around the country. Some groups still held modified versions of these gatherings, and they included on-site security or made them not open venues like outside at a flagpole. They moved them into like gyms and stuff like that, or at a library. Other schools just simply ended them altogether.
I mean, that's kind of odd, considering, like you pointed out, it didn't happen at a CU at the poll rally. It happened at a church event.
Yep. You know, at my school, at Everman, they were ended altogether. And for Everman, there was a church right across the street that was a pretty big church in my town, and they just started having them over there, but they were not allowed on campus after that. But yeah, I do think it's interesting because, again, it's one of the facts of this case that often gets misreported or the blame gets shifted onto these rallies when it really didn't have a lot to do with it at all. Lastly, I'll leave us with a positive note in this case. Remember the 17-year-old boy, Glenn Busey, that shoved his brother and best friend under the pews that was near Ashbrook when he started firing?
Yeah.
He went on to get his bachelor's degree from TCU, spent 8 years serving in the U.S. military, including 1 year in Afghanistan as a paratrooper, and was then hired by Arlington Police Department in 2010 as a member of Academy Class Number 42.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Good for him.
He is currently assigned to the Field Operations Bureau in the Patrol Division, and he was Officer of the Month a couple of years ago. His younger brother, Benji Busey, is a Fort Worth police officer as well, and they both actually have credited that fateful day in September of 1999 as the moment that it crystallized in their head that they needed to dedicate their lives to public service.
Oh, wow.
Jeremiah Netz later went back and got his high school GED. He started working towards a career. He got married and he had several kids. He's later gone on to become a leader and a mentor at his Southside Baptist Church.
Well, good for him.
Yeah. And that, my friends, is all I have for you today. That is episode 52, The Wedgwood Shooter.
Yeah, that's incredibly sad, but also super interesting. I mean, I feel like we talked a lot about this case, and there's a lot of other things, obviously, we could have gotten into that we didn't want to broach, really, on this platform. But I think there's a lot that you can think about, a lot of discussion points in this case. And, you know, it's really interesting because, I mean, I lived in Weatherford. I was in, what, this happened in 99. I was in junior high at the time. And I don't really remember it, to be honest. And that's very surprising to me.
Yeah, it really sticks out to me because I remember kids coming up to me with little tickets to, hey, see you at the poll. See you at the poll.
No,
I remember that.
I remember that too, but I don't remember this event. Like, I don't remember the shooting.
Well, I remember the shooting, and maybe it was because my grandparents lived, you know, pretty much in this neighborhood that it happened in. And man, it really shook this community on the south side of Fort Worth. But yeah, it was fascinating. And, you know, a couple of listeners have suggested this case to us months and months ago. I'd looked and looked and couldn't find their names specifically, but if you wrote in suggesting this case, we definitely appreciate it. Thanks for reminding me about it. While doing this case, it brought back a lot of memories of this case. And I was like, oh yeah, I remember that. I remember this. I remember that. But it's, yeah, it was a good one that I wanted to definitely cover for the memory of the victims and the survivors. I definitely want to go check out that memorial. And if you have time, go read those New York Times series of articles. They're really good. Go read Carlton Stower's article. They're very detailed, and you'll learn a lot more about this case.
Yeah, sounds good. We'll definitely do that. Well, is it time to switch gears?
Oh, yeah.
Move on to some good news. I have a really fun and funny good news for you.
Oh, awesome. Today. That's exactly what I need right now.
Okay, good. It involves some of your favorite things.
Ooh. We'll come back for that after this.
All right, Shay, so we've talked a lot about Chuck Norris on this podcast for obvious reasons.
Good old Chuck.
And when I saw this story, I knew it had to be featured on our good news segment because it is just perfect. So this was reported for Newsweek and by The Eagle, the local newspaper in College Station, but it was reported by several different places around. So there's lots of articles and pictures and stuff that you can see about this event. Well, this past weekend on May 4th, there was a Chuck Norris 5K in College Station. Have you heard about this?
No, but please tell me they do it in action jeans.
Oh, baby, you better believe it.
Oh, they do?
So 5,000 runners from 48 states and 7 countries participated in the 5K. Each of them, as part of like their runner's package, when you buy into a 5K, you get things for it. Each of them was given a fake Chuck Norris beard,
whoa,
a big old belt buckle, and a t-shirt that looked like the costume from his 1985 movie Invasion USA. So it looked like a big denim vest.
Wow.
So all of these people dressed up like Chuck Norris met at the George Bush Presidential Library at the Texas A&M campus. And the route went all around the campus and circled back to the library, where Chuck Norris himself, along with his wife Gina, were there to give the runners high fives as they crossed the finish line.
Holy moly.
Before the race, there was also Chuck Norris costume contests and martial arts exhibitions. The costume contest, you have to see these pictures. They're amazing. People went all out. I mean, it wasn't just what you were given as being a contestant in the 5K. It was like people dressed to the nines as Chuck Norris.
It's like Chuck Norris Comic-Con, basically.
Basically. The winner of Best Female Costume went to 96-year-old Lemurl Benton, who wore a Chuck Norris beard, a cowboy hat, and decorated her wheelchair to make it look like Chuck Norris's truck from Walker, Texas Ranger.
No, that's amazing.
And she does a little interview with The Eagle, and she talks about how she loves Chuck Norris. He's her, you know, her favorite actor. She watches him every day. On her recent 96th birthday, she had a Chuck Norris-themed birthday party.
Whoa. I want to go to a Chuck Norris-themed birthday party.
Hell yeah. Well, they're currently trying to submit the event to different organizations to see if it can be officially recognized for being the world record holder of most people in one place dressed as Chuck Norris.
Of course.
And I want to know how we weren't invited to this, how we didn't know about this.
Yeah.
Because it sounds amazing.
We would have gone and done a live show from the race.
Oh, absolutely. But it wasn't just fun and games. The 5K also served to raise money for charity. 100% of the proceeds of the 5K went to two charities that Chuck and Jean Norris are a part of. The first is their own nonprofit called the Kickstart Program, which helps get martial arts programs into middle schools. They've served thousands of Texas students. Currently, about 10,000 Texas students are taking martial arts through their program. So that's really cool. The second is the Mercy Project, which is a nonprofit organization working to end child slavery in Ghana. To quote its website at mercyproject.net, "We partner with families and communities trapped in the cycle of poverty, empowering them with sustainable economic solutions in order to free children from forced labor."
Wow, those are two great causes.
Yeah, absolutely. It's not just a crazy Chuck Norris party, although that's awesome, but they also raised money, and all of it went to really great causes. So overall, just sounds like the most incredible event. And if any listeners went to the Chuck Norris 5K and wants to post their costumes...
Oh, yeah. Put it in our Facebook discussion group,
please. I would love to see.
Yeah, you know, I love those two nonprofits that you mentioned, mainly because I got my start in a self-defense class before I went on to do martial arts later in life in a inner city program that was a nonprofit. So that touches my heart.
Yeah, exactly. Pretty cool story.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Aaron. Now we got to go out and get us some action jeans. All right, everybody. Welcome back to the after show. We got to do a little bit of throwing out some shout outs.
We're skipping our podcast recommendation of the week just because we are super busy and we don't have one ready to go in the lineup. So don't worry about that. We're going to continue doing that next week.
That's right.
But before we do our Patreon shout outs, let's do our social media shout outs. You can find us on Twitter at ACNC Podcast and on Instagram at All Crime No Cattle. You can write us an email at allcrimenocattle@gmail.com. You can like our page on Facebook, and we have our Facebook discussion group. We almost have 500 whole members.
Oh, wow. 500 members.
And you can join that, baby. It's the ACNC Posse Discussion Group.
And also remember, you can call our voicemail at 682-200-9972 and leave us something funny or something interesting to use on the show. Yeah, if you go and follow us on social media, you can see all of our pictures from the My Favorite Murder show that we got to go to.
Yes, we had a very good time. We saw Karen in Georgia, of course. It was our second time seeing My Favorite Murder live. But this time, we got treated like the moderately successful podcast that we are.
That's so right.
The city of Irvine hosted us and several other Texas podcasters from the area. So it was Lucas from the Nowhere Dispatch, Vincent and Christina from Gone Cold, and Lainey from True Crime Fan Club, and also our friend Marguerite from the Cowtown Crimes blog. So all of us were able to get to go have dinner together, go to the venue. We had really good seats.
Oh, they paid for valet parking and VIP entrance.
I know. We felt so fancy.
We had our own fancy bathroom. You know, the kind with like the colognes and lotions and stuff in there.
Oh, I didn't even know that. I didn't go to the bathroom.
Yeah, it was great.
They gifted us with a signed copy of The Midnight Assassin by Skip Hollandsworth.
We screamed a little when we got it.
We were so excited because the show before, so the Saturday show at that same venue, Skip Hollandsworth was actually there and he came out on stage. We did not see him or meet him, unfortunately, but we did get a signed copy of his book, which is pretty cool. And I'm going to tell people that I met him and that we're very good friends now.
Yeah, we didn't get to meet Skip Hollandsworth, but we did meet the mayor and the first lady of Irvine.
Yes, we did.
And he was awesome. He had a giant pretzel and some cheese.
He was. Yeah, he liked that. It was the world's biggest pretzel, and they were really nice. And yeah, it was so much fun. And thank you so much to Joy, Diana, and Lori for putting everything together. I know that they jumped through a lot of hoops and did a lot of hard work to make this happen for everyone, and we appreciated it so much. And it was just a really fun time. It was amazing.
We actually got spotted by a couple of fans who recognized us outside before the show started.
They didn't recognize us. You were like, oh, hey, guys, have you heard of All Crime, No Cattle?
No. Burr, burr,
burr. And then they were like, oh, yeah.
No.
They were excited.
Yeah, they were.
They were very nice. Thank you. I don't remember your names. I'm so sorry.
They were from Texarkana, though.
Yeah. Yeah, they were very sweet. So yeah, it was a very fun time.
It was.
And I felt like Miss Fancy Pants.
I know. And now we have to go back to being normal plebs.
Yeah. But it was cool.
Okay. So on to the shout outs. First off, as always, we need to thank our major producers of the show. That is our Texas Rangers. So that's Lisa Layton, Matthew McConnell. Serial.
Oh my God. I thought you were going to say Matthew McConaughey. Oh, wouldn't that be amazing?
No. No, he's a new Texas Ranger. Thank you, Matthew McConnell. Serial Killer Sweets, Michelle Guess, Drew Margerison, Kate Williams, Mel Thomas, and Don Maloney. You guys are rock stars, and thank you for all your support. Thank you for being a producer of the show.
Yay!
Next, we need to do small town sheriffs, and those include Angela Hoke Walker from Hoke Walker Designs, who does merch and like giveaway stuff for us. Elizabeth Campbell, Ashley Parker, our moderator from the Facebook group and one of our best friends.
Yeah, I don't know why she pays us.
Yes, she doesn't have to. She just
Ashley, stop paying us.
She's that awesome.
We should be paying you.
She pays us and moderates our Facebook group.
I know. I can't believe it. God, we're terrible friends.
Danny Jordan, he's a great guy. He's met us before. Christina Miller, Rebecca, Nikki Aldridge, Laura Romaine, Molly Smith, Rory Williams, Heather Nelson, and that's it. That's everybody. Thank you, small town sheriffs and Texas Rangers. Keep on keeping on. We couldn't do it without you. It's getting better and better thanks to you. I hope. Maybe it's not. Maybe it's getting worse. I don't know.
Oh, God.
I feel like we're working harder. I don't know.
Yeah.
No. Don't laugh right at that. Like I'm lying that we're working harder.
No, I mean, we are. It's exhausting what we do.
It is. We're actually up in the middle of the night and we have a lot to do.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. But we're here with you.
You should see the state of our house.
Oh, it's awful.
I'm not even going to tell you what's still sitting in our living room.
Nope, we're not going to mention it.
We like to make fun of ourselves a lot, but you know what? That's humiliating. Like, it's sad. The most embarrassing thing.
Well, the thing is we have a lot of spring cleaning to do, and yeah. We're almost out of spring. We're almost into full-blown summer.
Oh, yeah.
And we just have all this, like, prepped and ready spring cleaning that is just waiting to be finished. So maybe we'll get to it. We might have to take a break from the show to clean our damn house.
Yeah.
Well, anyways...
That was interesting, I'm sure, for everyone.
Yeah.
Thank you guys for listening, and we will be back next week with another episode.
And always remember, y'all, crime is bigger in Texas. Adios.
Bye.